Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
And we're the hosts of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, where we bring you stories that delve into the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This week, it's episode 58. This week, we have a good friend of mine, Ailsa McDonald, on the show. Ailsa is a former marathoner, a 244 marathoner, former Ironman athlete, gas in that sport. And then only 6 years ago, she came over to the ultra marathoning scene and decided to kick ass here too, winning Bandera 100K, Tarawera 100 mile, Black Canyon 100K. And just only a week ago, ran alongside of me and kicked my ass by about 3 hours. At the Sinister 7 100-mile race in the Crow's Nest Pass in Canada, breaking her own course record, running 18 hours and 19 minutes, obliterating the course and the rest of the field. Phenomenal performance, and I was so happy to run even just the first little bit with her and seeing her athletic abilities where she does her very best. Just an absolute star. Now, Ailsa is planning to go to UTMB later on this year. And in my opinion, I think she's the favorite. I could see her walking away with the big win at UTMB and kind of breaking a lot of hearts there. But travel restrictions and on and so forth, I can't wait to talk to her about that, seeing if this is something that can happen. Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, Ailsa.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Ailsa, thanks for being on. And I guess you're 1 week removed or so from your feat at the Sinister 7. How are you feeling?
Not bad, actually. Definitely there was a lot of fatigue, but the body's bouncing back pretty good. I haven't tried running yet, but I'm doing lots of active recovery and hanging out with family and just having a pretty low-key week. It's been really good.
Well, that's awesome. Good. But before we get too deep into that and some of the other races, you know, we love to learn a little bit more about who you are and how you found your way into endurance sports, you know, because we're finding, I think, after talking to, you know, over 50 people about it, there is a little bit of a pattern forming, but they're all different in their own way. So, you know, we go back in the way back machine. Were you a runner in high school or after high school? You know, what was it that sort of made it appealing to you to go for longer and longer periods of time?
I've always been athletic. So in high school, it was sports, like pretty much every sport that was going, basketball, softball, soccer. We didn't have much of a track or cross country team. So I did mostly team sports, but I mean, there was a lot of running involved. I ran on my own just to stay fit. I was always really inspired by my high school principal, who was a marathon runner. He was going to the Boston Marathon, and I just thought he was such a big deal. He ended up starting a cross-country running team in my 12th year, like my last year of high school, and I learned a lot from him, and I joined the team, of course, and I did really well in cross-country. So I think that was kind of the start of my running career. And after high school, when all those sports sort of dissipated and I still needed a way to keep fit, I got into triathlon because I was always a big cyclist, not so much competitively, but just as a means of transportation growing up. I cycled everywhere. So I happened to be quite strong on the bike and I had my run background from all the sports. Swimming was just a challenge. So yeah, it was just a way to stay involved in sports. So I think that's where I started off. Was triathlon and everything kind of morphed from there.
And so the beginning of triathlon, Ailsa, I mean, was that kind of find, you know, your own personal limits? Was that, you know, were there a bunch of, you know, triathletes around you in your circle of friends? Why triathlon? I mean, you know, it's easy to kind of pick up cycling as an endurance sport or running as an endurance sport, but you know, kind of pinning all three together, why triathlon?
It started, I joined the military right out of high school. So of course it was another part of my life that kept me in really good shape because, you know, you always had to go to physical training and meet certain physical limitations in order to stay in. So pretty much everybody I hung out with was really active and fit. So I always like connected with people that were going out on adventures or running and doing really cool sporty things, because that was kind of my my hobbies. So I met this guy in the military, and he said he was going to do a triathlon. And I didn't really know much about the sport at the time. But I thought that sounded really challenging. I thought it was really cool that he was going to do this. And I was kind of jealous. I'm like, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I had the cycling and the running background. So I thought, maybe I'll learn to swim and I'll see if I can do all three. I grew up in a small town in Nova Scotia, Bridgewater, down on the South Shore, and they actually had a little triathlon club. So I got involved with them and started doing little training evenings with them a couple of times a week, and they did bits of swimming, and then they get on the bike and then do the run. So I signed up for my first triathlon, and I signed up for an Olympic was the first one, which is 1500 meter swim, 40K bike, 10K run. And everybody in the club laughed at me. They're like, you're going to start with an Olympic? Like, most people start with sprint, which is like half that distance. And I didn't really know what I was getting into. I thought, oh, I'll just give it a go and see if I can finish it. I really didn't have any big time goals or anything in mind. I just wanted to challenge myself and see if I could complete this event. And I ended up doing really well and just got hooked.
Mm-hmm. You know, the triathlon, it's interesting, Ironman to ultra. I do think that that's a pattern of some sort. You know, I did the same thing. I'd done 6 Ironman races, and I heard a friend of mine say he did this 100-mile run. And I'm like, that's not possible, you know? And then I ended up doing a 50-mile run, and I remember it was really hard to walk for 3 or 4 days. But then, yeah, it sort of gets deeper and deeper into you, you know, because I think it's the idea of going for longer periods of time gets somewhat appealing. What was it that pushed you out of triathlon and into the ultra space? What was it that you liked about it?
Well, I was never pushed out of triathlon. I still do them. Still, oh, okay. I still love Ironman. I still love to cycle. I love the cross training, but I get a little bit bored, and I was on like my third Ironman, and you know, my whole life consisted of swim, bike, run. And by this time, with a couple Ironmans under my belt and having knowing that I had that talent for endurance sport, and seeing all these people starting to do these long distance trail runs, and just being drawn to the mountains. I've always been really drawn to the mountains. And so after a few Ironmans, I thought, I kind of want to switch it up a bit. Maybe I'll like test the waters and the long distance trail running. So that's kind of where the ultra started.
And when you did that, did you have in your head that you could be good enough to be at the front of the pack or win races?
No, not at all. Because when I got into ultra running, I was living in a place called St. Albert, just north of Edmonton. And I was probably hours from any sort of trail. So the first probably 4 or 5 years, up until very recently, actually, of my ultra running career was all pavement running, like all road background. So to get on the trails and do racing and actually come out with wins and really good times, it was really shocking to me, because I didn't do any trail running. I didn't do any like vertical in my training other than like hill repeats within my marathon program. So I kind of shocked everybody, including myself, when I got into the ultra scene.
Yeah, so explain that, Ilse, because I think that there's a lot of people that live in prairie provinces or prairie states or anywhere in the world that doesn't really have a lot of hills. We're very blessed, myself, we're us now living close to the mountains where we can end up getting out to the Canadian Rockies and running, steep vertical. So was there any tricks or was there any, specific training plans or did you think that your fitness was able to kind of translate to running up and down mountains well?
I think it was a multitude of things. growing up, I spent my summers in Scotland with my grandfather, who's a mountaineer. So I spent my summers in the mountains in Scotland. So we were always doing like multi-day backpacking trips. And we would often do like a range of peaks, and he would do the main summit with me. And because he had done them all before, he would just kind of hang out in the saddle with I leave my backpack with him, and he's like, okay, you go run those peaks so that you finish the range kind of thing. So I was really young when I was doing that, but I remember loving it. And I remember it was hard. And I liked that. I loved running uphill hard and getting to the summit and seeing the view. So I think there was a bit of muscle memory there. And like I said, that the mountains just give me that energy. But I think too, obviously my ability, like I had come from the marathon background. So I had that ability to suffer for long, long periods of time, because the marathon is a long time at a high intensity. So that was good training. And I've always been big on strength training. So I've always done lots of weightlifting in the gym and stuff like that. So when I decided that I was going to get into ultra running, and I signed up for Black Canyon 100K, which was my first 100K back in 2017, without having access to the trails, I thought, okay, I need to be creative in order to be strong on the trails without having access to trails. So what I did was I stuck to my basic marathon program, but I threw in a bunch of really heavy leg workouts before every long run that I did. And then I came up with these workouts that were like hill repeats, and you get off the treadmill to do like squats or deadlifts or some sort of leg exercise, and then you get back on. And so I think that really prepared me to be strong on the trail.
That's super smart. I like that.
Black Canyon, I've done it twice. It's certainly an interesting race, you know, because early in the year, you never know what weather you're going to get. You know, will the river be flooded? And a couple of years they've had to change the course. But it's really an interesting race because it's not like got a big vert, like up a big mountain, but there's a lot of those just ups and downs and ups and downs that can certainly wear you out. Did you feel like it was a course that was good for you, the design of the course?
Well, the first year I did it was one of the years that it flooded.
Yeah.
So in 2017, they rerouted the course. So we ended up doing a 50K out and back. So we basically ran downhill for 50K, and then we turned around and ran uphill for 50K.
Yeah.
So, and it was one of the years that the weather was really bad. It was cold, rainy, just absolutely miserable. Lots of mud on the course. So it added its extra challenges, but I think having the uphill in the second half was an advantage to me because I was strong on the uphill. So I did do well on that course. Getting into ultra running, actually, the thing I suffered at most until I moved to the mountains was the downhill running. That's where I always fell apart. So I was able to build up a good uphill fitness without trail, but that downhill fitness, I think, can only be built on the trails, on steep descent.
Well, and I think that, Ailsa, you, and this is a private conversation we're having, so of course the guests weren't privy to this, but so yeah, and that really translated as well to at Western States. I remember following you the one year, and you were doing so good, and then there seemed to be a steep cliff. Was it the downhill on that course?
It was a few things. I definitely went out too hard in Western States, but once you do the escarpment, so you do the big climb at the beginning, there's about a 25K downhill stretch. And at the time, I was not in good downhill running condition. And by the time I hit the bottom of that, my quads were absolutely shredded, like to the point where my muscles actually hurt at about not even 50 miles into the race.
Mm-hmm.
Like muscle soreness that early on. So definitely a lack of downhill training contributed to my not so great race there.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to get you back out doing some downhills again. Yeah, the field of racing though is becoming rather competitive, especially in the women's field. There's really a lot of amazing women who are just ripping up the course. I mean, this year at Western States, it was very ultra competitive. And so with Dave challenging you here to go win at UTMB, That's a tall order. But how do you see, you know, the female ultra community evolving? What do you know? Because now you're sort of right at the center of it.
Well, you have a lot of young up and comers. The field is definitely strong now. I mean, it was it's still a relatively new sport, and I think it's only going to grow, and you're only going to get more and more competitive as the years go on. And I think it's really exciting. Like, I watched Western States this year. I was just absolutely glued to the live feed. I couldn't believe it. It was just so exciting, both the men and women's field. So I think it's fantastic that there's that level of competition now in the women's side.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you think about yourself, Ailsa, you know, you've only been at this for what, 6 years, you know, at the ultra running, you know, and so, and you've got all these incredible athletes, incredible endurance athletes that are coming from somewhere, and they want to really get excited and deposit their, you know, their efforts somewhere. And so, yeah, like ultra running, especially mountain ultra running, it's huge. And so are there a lot of, you know, at the races that you go to, Ailsa, are there a lot of these unknowns that pop up and dominate? Are you quite surprised by a lot of these unknown performances?
I'm not surprised at all. Kind of being one of them, because I mean, when I showed up at my first ultra, I had no idea what I was capable of. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. There's people out there that are just going out to challenge themselves, and they get on the trails and they realize, wow, I have talent. You never know until you try. So I think there's always going to be one or two black horses in the race that really dominate, that you just don't expect. You may have never heard their name before or whatever. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
how does it, like, when you do a 100-miler, you know, for some of our listeners, there's, you know, some of us who are just trying to get to the finish, and then there's others like yourself who are trying to win the race. How does your strategy evolve in something that's that long, you know? In this idea of, well, you run your own race, or do you run with other people, stay in the lead pack? You know, like, what's your sort of approach as you go at a big, long race?
I personally like to run my own race. And, you know, I don't go in these 100 milers to win it. I remember saying to a girlfriend of mine just before Sinister 7, it was her first 100 miler. And that was her attitude. She's just in it to finish. And I remember going into Sinister 7, which was my first 100 miler in 2017, and that was my attitude as well. I'm just in it to finish. And honestly, I think even as an experienced ultra runner, that is the way to go into an ultra marathon, because it doesn't matter how physically and mentally prepared you are for that race. There are so many unknowns. And if you're not able to adapt on the go and accept that you may not have the race of your life, then you could end up with a DNF, or, you know, the race being a lot worse than what it actually should be.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And yeah, I couldn't agree with you. Also, I think that there's, everybody's out there doing something different, and some people push hard off of a start line. Other people, you know, they create a surge early or whatever. In our case, only a week ago at Sinister 7, you know, there was a lot of heat on the course. You know, some said that it got up to 36 degrees, which I think is about 100. And on the course out on leg 3 and 4. So how did you handle, you know, the heat, and how did you handle the kind of the pacing and the strategy, specifically just even a week ago?
I think I got really lucky actually, coming into ultra running when I did, because in 2017, when I ran Sinister as my first 100 miler, we were in the middle of a heat wave. And so days before, I'm looking at forecast, and I saw that it was going to be 37 on race day. And of course, I just thought, okay, I know I'm going to have to really slow down and pace myself. Otherwise, I'm never going to make it. So ever since then, I have always gotten extreme temperatures on race day, whether it was Ironman or ultra running. But this Sinister 7 was one of the cooler races I have ever done, believe it or not. I'm pretty lucky, because I think because I'm so small, I manage heat really well. Nobody performs their best in hot temperatures, but I think I manage it better than most people. So it slows me down, but not as much as it would slow down most people. So I think I managed it really well. I actually didn't even notice the heat on legs 3 and 4 this year. And it wasn't until after race that someone told me, yeah, it hit like 35 on race day. I'm like, what? I didn't even, we had a breeze too. So, I mean, that helped, but yeah, I was okay with it.
Yeah. This idea that I like, you know, when you start off, I think we all say, yes, we want to get to the finish line. And you can still run hard and all that, but it is rather unpredictable, right? The distance over time. Like, of course, this past weekend with Hard Rock, you know, Courtney had to drop out because of stomach problems, and she's clearly one of the best that's ever run ultra races. So you, that's a very tough one to really figure out the GI system and, you know, fueling yourself. Do you have some strategies that you've worked on, or are you sort of dynamic in the moment figuring it out?
As far as nutrition, you mean, or yeah, or just
nutrition? Yeah, your nutrition plan.
I've been really lucky. I have never really suffered from GI issues. There's always a point in the 100-miler where I kind of lose my appetite, and it's really hard to get the calories in. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'm down to like really simple foods like candies and chips. So I think like the last couple of legs with Sinister Seven, I was down to just taking like the odd bit of candy and chips every once in a while. And even though I didn't want to eat, I knew I had to. And those were the most palatable things. So what I try and do is just eat as much as I can early on in the race when your digestive system is still working really well. I like to eat real foods, Lara bars, peanut butter sandwiches, things like that. I take ginger ale or ginger beer to settle my stomach. Candy, ginger, things like that. So yeah, I mean, that can definitely be something that's unpredictable, but I kind of make sure that I have a selection of sweet, salty, and like a variety of foods on hand so that I have a choice of taking in anything that I might be able to consume.
Yeah, and I think another part of that, also kind of going on about a little bit about fueling and what you have on board is also who's serving it to you. And so I know Barry, your husband, extremely well, and Barry is, you know, the most incredible human being. So why don't you spend a couple of minutes talking a little bit about Barry? And he's the most supportive guy in the world. So maybe tell our audience a little bit about this guy.
Oh, he definitely is. I mean, I wouldn't be half the athlete I am today if it wasn't for him. When I got into ultras, my plan was in 2017, I was going to run Black Canyon 100K and see how that went before I signed up for Sinister 700 miler, because that was my ultimate goal. Was I want to do the 100 mile challenge. Mm-hmm. Sinister 7 was starting to fill up even before I did Black Canyon. So I was like, oh gosh, maybe I should register, but I don't know if I can't finish 100K, maybe I shouldn't do 100 miler, and how am I going to know? And I was like, I think you should sign up. I think that you can do it. So I'm like, okay, here goes. So I signed up. And when, you know, months before the race, I'm kind of like running through everything in my head, how to prepare for it and everything. And he's researching how to be the best crew for your athlete. So putting together kit lists, and he's reading blogs of crew people and watching YouTube videos and just learning all the tricks of the trade. So that he the best support crew out there. And that was just amazing, because he ended up not only supporting me, but a lot of my other friends on the course that day.
Absolutely. So. And I can, I he's not just, you know, incredibly good at supporting your crew, but his energy and his just so relaxed. He's funny, you know, you're in, you're out. Just very jovial. He's an incredible human being, and no question, you know, us runners are only as good of as our crews, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, he's pretty amazing.
It is an interesting part of the sport that I think a lot of people from the outside don't really know and understand, that that's integral to, you know, when you take on some big challenge, having that. And we like to sort of celebrate them. I think they enjoy it as much, and it's fun when we get to crew other people. Mm-hmm. It is part of what makes, I think, ultra different than, say, running a marathon or doing an Ironman, where you don't have that personal connection. You know, it's just the people who are volunteering for the race. And and so it's fun to have, you know, that familiar face or someone who knows you. I'm sure we've all found that moment when, for example, you don't feel like eating and someone's like, okay, here's something, right? Did, like, for example, did you have a pacer during Sinister 7?
Or anything? No, Sinister doesn't allow pacers, but I typically don't use a pacer anyway. I never have.
Oh, that's pretty bold there. That's a, it's a good strategy if you can pull it off, right?
I like to suffer alone, I guess.
Or when you're passing everybody. Yeah.
That's not always the case.
So Ailsa, let's, I want to also, talk a little bit about your mom. Because, let's, do a little bit of mom bragging here. So let's face it, your fitness isn't entirely, not non-genetic. You've got a really strong family and probably some pretty good genetics coming down on the pipe. Can you tell us a little bit about your mom and some of her running endeavors?
Oh, yeah. So my mom got into running later in life. I think when she was around 40, she joined a run club, and it kind of stemmed from my activity as she was coming to my triathlons and seeing the race atmosphere, and she kind of got really hooked. So she started, she joined a run club, and then she got into racing herself. Now, she started with the short distances like we all do. And I remember she would say, oh, I'm never running a marathon. That's crazy. She came to Boston with me when I ran it for the first time in 2010. And when after the race, I got all my race photos and I got one as a postcard. And I sent it to my mom and I said, you should do two marathons, one to qualify for Boston and one to run Boston so we can do it together. Mm-hmm. So she did. She ran her first marathon. She kicked ass. I think she was like second or third female overall. And that, this is like, she was, I think, 59 or 58 or 59 when she ran her first marathon. Wow. And she ran a 3:30. And I think she set a course record for the age group on the course she ran. And so then that was 2016. And we got to experience Boston together. And her first Boston, she ended up placing in her age group. So she kept getting invited back every year because she was doing so well.
How many times have you run Boston?
Three.
Yeah, I've done it five times. And each year, the weather was different. It's one of the craziest races because you never know if you're going to get the cold and the rain or the hot. And it's just, but I think it's the best marathon. Well, at least of all the ones I've ever done, it's the most fun. Love the people. The course is great.
Yeah, I've done it three times and every time was a different experience. But the last time I did it was really cool because it was myself, my mom, and my sister that got to go together. So
wow. Pretty cool. Yeah, I did it. What is it? I can't remember now. Is it 2019 when the horrible weather, or was it 18 when it was Des Linden won?
It was 2017, I think.
Yeah.
Because I did 2018.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're right. And yeah, that's right. It would have been 17. And that was the year it was like in the 40s and pouring rain. And people were dropping out left and right because it was just so cold. And
My mom did it that year and she ended up dropping out at mile 20 with hypothermia. And she just dropped off the tracking app and then we couldn't get a hold of anybody and didn't know where she was or how she was doing. So it was really frightening. I mean, that was a particularly bad year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I remember one of the women pros dropped out at actually mile 25, which is sort of fascinating to think that, you could get that far and still drop out because she was couldn't even make it one more mile. Yeah. That's and the whole qualifying thing is sort of a fun experience to make that as a goal,
for sure, and
to make that happen. In that regard, are there ultras that you have sort of in your mind that you want to go out and do? Like, I guess we'll talk about UTMB here. So that's got to be at the top of the list, right, of races to get out and do. What else?
Well, I'll go back to Western States. I mean, there was a bit of the hold for the years that everything was canceled because COVID. So I was supposed to do Western States in last year and then it got canceled. This year I had to roll my entry because I couldn't travel still. So the UTMB was definitely on my list. So hopefully I get to go this year, but who knows? So like right now I already have like next year planned with Western States and UTMB coming up here. So there's definitely, every time I do a race, I add another one to the bucket list. So I have I do have a long list of ones that I'd like to tackle. Those two being the biggest ones. But yeah, there's just so many great courses out there and you can just never stop exploring.
And I think there's so many really beautiful parts of the world to explore and races to go and try to conquer and things. But also, like, when it comes to your success in the last many years, it's you end up seeing a number of runners that have success for a couple of years and they kind of drop off and they might come back and on and so forth. You've been pretty consistent in your drive and your dedication to your craft. What is it that kind of motivates you? What moves you to continue pushing the needle as hard as you've been pushing it?
Passion. I think that a lot of people use running as an emotional outlet, and I don't. I don't have any sort of emotional connection to running, so I don't do it because I'm stressed. I don't do it because I need to settle my mind or whatever. I just do it because I love it. And I think what happens is sometimes people get into races and if they're not having a good day, they get very emotional and it's a bit scarring. Whereas for me, if I fall apart in a race, it's not really life altering. I go back seeking redemption. I let fuel my fire. I'm like, okay, it didn't happen this time, but you're damn right it's going to happen next time. So I love the training. I love racing. I'm okay to fall apart. I accept that. I know it's part of the sport. I embrace it. It makes me stronger. And I think it's a mental thing.
I like that. Yeah. Because you're right. There's a lot of people that I find, when they say my name is Austin McDonald and I am a runner, and they solely put themselves behind that. And when they fail at running, they fail at being a human being. They fail at being a person, and they take it very personally, and they have to dig a hole and go and hide in it, and they get off social media because they can't. And you don't seem to be that person. It just seems like, hey, you know what? This is a really hard sport where the element of failure is pretty high. I mean, even at Sinister Seven, they'll say, what was the percentage of the DNFs at that race? It was like, it's really high. 25%. That's insane. That's insane. And so the chances of you failing are actually pretty high. It seems like you don't really get faltered by that.
I try not to. You're going to have a bad race. Like, it's inevitable. In this sport, you're bound to have a bad day in any sport. And mine was definitely Western States, my worst race so far. And I attribute that mostly to going out too hard. So it was a mistake that I made in the beginning. I always say that it's one of my best races because it's the hardest I have ever had to fight for a finish. And I am so proud of myself for not throwing in the towel and just giving up. And I think there was a lot of growth at that race.
Yeah, I think that we've been, of course, talking to lots of very successful people in this sport and in other, difficult sports. And, there's this question that runs everyone's head is when, performance seems to get a little bit less than it was. Can we figure out what's happening? And is that sort of the beginning or the end? Is it an opportunity versus, maybe I'm not as good as I used to be. I think that there's maybe some connection to the motivation that's lost rather than the physical being not being able to go forward. I've won a lot. And you're not saying this explicitly, but you're saying it sort of, by just the nature of how we go at it. Do you think that because this is so hard that there's a point where it's like we don't fight as hard against it to that point of you finishing Western States and sticking it out? And do you think that more than anything we just have to accept that it's at highs and lows because of the difficulty?
I think we have to accept the highs and lows. I think what we have to do is not let it affect our confidence when we do have those low moments. and those bad races, because once your confidence takes a kicking, then it's really hard to get back on the horse and be strong again. It's the majority is mental, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we're last week's podcast guest, that was one of the topics that we just continued on about. Jake Jackson was about confidence and belief in oneself. And once you don't have it, you don't have it. And, yeah. You know, I remember a while back, Joe, we ended up having a guest on. He was a Navy SEALs guy. And, you know, he was giving some advice to runners. You know, I think it was about backyard racing. And, you know, in order for you to drop to the ground and do 200 push-ups, you know, the key was to have a really long runway. You're hitting the ground thinking you're doing 500. And so when you're thinking you're doing 500, that 200 is pretty easy. But, you know, when you lack the confidence and you hit the ground, it seems like a sport of 100-mile really difficult trail races that without confidence, you don't have it. Has your confidence gone up and down throughout your career as an ultra runner or as an Ironman athlete? I mean, do you notice that certain years don't think you have another year's, your confidence is through the roof?
I think I have a lot of self-confidence. Not that I think I'm going to go out and win everything, but just with the attitude that I'm capable and able to accept the challenges and the hurdles that the day is going to throw at me. The last couple of years have been interesting because I turned 40. Then this year I turned 41 just a couple of days ago. So you always have that fear that age is going to slow you down. Because I mean, inevitably we all do slow down with age. And I haven't raced since, you know, for the last 18 months. So I wasn't quite sure, you know, where I was as far as fitness and comparability to other athletes. I have noticed that I'm slower in road running, like my interval paces are slower. And I don't know if that is because of my age. It could be because I spend more time on the trails now than doing road workouts. So my legs are always pretty trash when I'm going to my speed workouts. So, or is it because I didn't exactly do structured training the whole time we've been in COVID? There are so many factors. So it was really cool to get back out there on the course at Sensor 7. And especially that course, because I have a time to compare my old self to, because I did it in 2017. So it was like, now is a good test. I can really see where I'm at and like fitness wise. So even though Sensor 7 wouldn't have been my race of choice for this year, because I was supposed to do Western States, it still gave me, it still tested my limits. And, you know, I had that 2017 time to chase. And it was really interesting to do that and really fun.
I'm sure there are moments where it might not have been that fun, but
no doubt.
So you did push through. That's I think that the training is getting more and more specific though. I don't think you can, you know, be the fastest ultra runner and then go run a 2:25 marathon. You know, I think there's a very different sort of profile of training that gets us to the top of, you know, any of the disciplines. And so I think I wasn't as fast as either of you guys, but I found that when I was running a marathon on the road every month, I mean, I could tell exactly where I should be. You know, I had it was such a different kind of race. You know, I like, here's how I should feel at mile 15, at mile 19, at 24. And you could almost sort of predict your time, like you really could. In ultra race, I don't have that kind of intimacy with it because it's not the same. You know, 100 miles, whatever, Sinister 7 is very different than Western States or very different than any of the other hundreds you might go do. And so I think it brings a different kind of sort of both training, but also perspective during the race itself, because it's harder to, it isn't as predictable. So I think that's where good ultra runners, the mindset matters the most, you know, with how you might feel like as well. I feel terrible. That was it 2 years ago, whatever, was in Western States, and whoever ended up coming in second or third had been dropped back to like seventh or eighth place in the men's, and he was walking for like 10 miles. And then his legs came back together, his body, and he ran like crazy at the end. Like sometimes you don't even know that could happen. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So I guess you're figuring that out as you go along.
Oh, definitely. But yeah, I do agree with you. I don't think I can't be at my fastest in the marathon when I'm doing all this trail running, because a marathon is very specific training, and training for a 100-miler is very specific training. So to be your best at both at the same time would be very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I love the trails, and I love them more so than the roads. So I'm spending more time on them. So I'm letting my road time sort of diminish or get slower. I'm sacrificing my road times for my mountain running. And right now I feel like, yeah, I might be in the slowest road shape of my life, but I'm in the best mountain shape of my life. So where do you want to excel?
Yeah, no doubt. And so yes, I also like asking the question about, you know, because it seems like, you know, ultra runners are kind of up for anything, you know, any type of challenge, is nothing really that scares them. But I think that there's something that scares everyone. You know, like for me, bad water, you know, that, you know, 135, you know, degree heat or whatever the hell it gets to in there down at Furnace Creek, you know, that scares the hell out of me. And I would never sign up for a race like that. There, you know, track races, road races, you know, there's stage races, backyard races. Is there anything that you haven't tried? There's two questions here. Is there any race that you haven't tried that you really want to try? Or is there any other races out there that you wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole?
I can't think of anything that I want that's really on my bucket list, like something completely different that I haven't tried yet. I kind of toyed with the idea of doing like the backyard ultras and the track races and stuff, but that kind of scares me because I know that I don't do well with sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'm willing to go down that hole because I'm a bit of a miserable person when I get into that sort of sleep deprived state. And it takes me a really, really long time to recover from stuff like that. So I'm just not willing to put my body through that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one race that I will never really get involved in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about when I think about you and I think about your endurance and your strength, you know, really, really kicks in. I find at the 60 and 80 and 90 mile mark of 100 miles, but even more so at the 150 and 170 mile mark of a 200 mile race. What about 200 milers? Does the sleep deprivation kind of intimidate you enough to kind of keep you away from those ideas?
I don't know. I think 100 miles is enough for me.
I think it's enough for most people, absolutely.
I mean, I'm willing to go the 170K for UTMB, you know, like I'll do a little bit extra, but yeah, I don't think I'll ever do the 200 miler.
Mm-hmm. Is Barclays at all interesting to you?
Nope. Nothing that I have to self-navigate.
Mm. Yeah, that's a tough, that adds a new dimension to it, doesn't it?
That does. Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'm not very intelligent when I run. I kind of like my mind is very in the zone. So I like to do marked courses so I don't have to think about anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to self-navigate, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I've done my fair share of adventure racing, and having a topo map and a compass in the middle of the night is never easy to deal with.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's a different challenge. Yeah. I suppose you could mentally prepare for that and train differently, but yeah, I just like to run hard and not think about it.
Oh, mm-hmm. So then what about Hard Rock? That must be something interesting to you. It's 100, that's really hard.
Yeah, that one looks pretty, pretty, pretty fun. I think I would like to get into that one.
Mm-hmm. I wish a race like that would allow more people in. I know that there's these limitations, but it just seems like another 50 people couldn't put that much more harm on the environment, you know, like it would just be fun to see a few more people. And I know they did make a change in there this year. They said that they're going to have proportional number of women accepted in the race that apply, because it ends up being too few women in the race. And so that's a problem, but they're working to fix that. So you might have a good shot at getting in if you apply here coming up. We'll come down and crew you.
Cool.
Well, we'll join up with your husband and help him out.
Yeah, no doubt. So yeah, so what scares you about the kind of the track 24-hour races? Is it the monotony? Is it the sleep deprivation? Because 24 hours isn't much different than the 18 hours that you just ran at Sinister Seven. So is it the flat monotony?
No, actually, I did actually do a 6-hour track run. I did it as a training run actually a few years ago, and I found myself enjoying it. The monotony. Mm-hmm. You could really get into the zone, because you really don't have to think when you're running around in a circle. Like, it's logistically simple. You don't have to think about technical terrain. Everything, you're passing your aid station every 400 meters. So I did like that about it. When I do a 24 hours, I don't know. I think I'm just too involved and have too much love for the mountains to kind of change my training plan right now.
You have plenty of time, when we look at the likes of what, Bob Hearn and Joe Fiches and other, and these guys are over 50 years old and are doing amazing times at 24 or 48. Well, Olivier is, I think, 48 or 49. And, his record, his U.S. record, I think, for 24 is 170.6, and his 48 hours 262 miles, so 10 marathons in 2 days
that wow.
he around the track, wow. And it's so, so you still have many years ahead of you to go and try those too.
Oh, maybe when I get bored of the mountains, I'll switch to track running then.
Yeah, and you did say also earlier, you did say that you get bored easily. So, the world is, now you see the insurgence of backyard racing, and you see everything, and the world's getting bigger and brighter, and people are going out and finding their limitations, or trying to exceed their limitations, rather, at all different events. And it's so great. So any advice to kind of newcomer trail runners? I'm sure there's a lot of trail runners out there. You take even Sinister Seven, the race that we were at last week, a lot of the runners are relay teams. So a lot of these runners are running 10, 20, 30 kilometer legs. And they're looking at people like you, Ailsa, who are just, dominating. And they really look at you like a superhero. And they think, if there's any wisdom that she can throw my way of, maybe one day I could run like Ailsa. Where do runners start? Like going from, let's say, the 10 or half marathon, trail distances to kind of the 100-mile trail world?
I think it's a compilation of a lot of things. You have to be strong, so do your strength training. You have to be able to suffer, so high intensity training is definitely an asset. Mental training, being able to zone out, being able to tackle whatever hurdles are thrown at you, so being able to adapt and overcome and think quickly on your feet. And then, of course, there's the nutrition side of it and learning what works for you, because everybody is different in that respect. So I can't tell people, okay, you have to eat this to run 100 miles, because that may not work for them. There's so much trial and error. I think it's, you really have to think about all of those things and put them all together and play with everything until you just have that perfect recipe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, I'll be a little bit of a heretic or challenge the convention in ultra running that, I guess that whatever the best plan is the one that you throw out in a race. And there's these old, I've never really liked what we would call in the US these old wives' tales. People tell you something and they learn to believe it, but there's no real basis in fact. It was always like we were told when we were young, don't go swimming after you eat. You might get a cramp and you'll drown. I'm like, well, then there wouldn't be such a thing as an Ironman race, because then you wouldn't be able to swim after having your gel, you know, like, and all these things. And then the one though in racing that I'm finding is sort of funny is everyone says, don't ever try anything new in a race. If you haven't eaten it before, don't try it. And, you know, like, don't introduce something new. I'm like, well, but I never, like, I did the Javelina 100 a couple years ago, and I've never eaten pumpkin pie in the middle of a race. And they had pumpkin pie. It was the only thing I wanted to eat. And it was so delicious. I never did. I don't know who other than Dave trains eating pumpkin pie during, you know, your training. And I'd like to just, my opinion, you can tell me if you agree or not, is to try and debunk this idea. It doesn't mean that we should just throw everything away. You know, there's some things that work, but when it doesn't, we have to be open to trying something new that will help us get to the finish line, which is sort of one of the things I feel I've learned in the whatever 40 or so ultra marathons I've done. Is I love peanut butter sandwiches until I can't eat them anymore. And then what do I do? You know, like, almost always can eat potato chips and Coke. That I've almost never run out of interest in, you know, like, especially if you really can't chew, just pour the Coke in your mouth and it mushes up the potato chip. And it's perfect, right? You get salt, fat, and sugar. Like, that's about as good as it gets. So what's your thought on, you know, yeah, have a plan, but we don't have to hold too hard to this idea that we can't try anything new.
I agree with you 100%. Now, I don't think that you should run an ultramarathon in a brand new pair of shoes that you've never worn before.
I agree
with that. But when it comes to nutrition, absolutely. Whatever you can get in your system is better than nothing. Funny story, in 2017, when I ran my first 100 miler, it was super hot, record high temperatures that day. It was Sinister 7. I came in off of leg 3. We had a cooler full of beer for the crew. They sat me down and they said, okay, what do you want? I said, all I want right now is a cold beer. So they handed me a beer and I chugged it back and I went back out on the course and I went on to win the race outright with it. But it didn't, like, and it didn't affect me, but that was, that beer tasted so good, because after running 60, 80 kilometers in 40 degree weather, drinking hot Gatorade or hot sports drinks and water, like, that cold beer was game changer.
Yeah, and I think the other part of that is, you know, I've listened to Dave a lot, and he has his eating habits, and one of the things that he and Pete Kostelnik say, which I love, this is like should be their main quote, which is that, you know, ultra running is an eating contest. That the best ultra runners are the ones who can eat, and Pete is phenomenal at eating. Like, right, he ran from Alaska to Florida, 98 days, whatever, 60 miles a day, you know, across the country. You can only do that if you can keep food going, right? And the irony of what we do often is the more active you are, the less you want to eat. Mm-hmm. And then the less active you are, the more you want to eat. You know, it's like sit around on the couch and you're like really hungry, go out for a run and you're like, I don't need food. So we do think that that's a big part of being successful. And, you know, there are some rules that should be broken, you know, when you're out there, like, well, I don't eat potato chips. Well, you just are trying to survive, you know, that's what matters.
Yeah. And then I think ultimately, guys, like, you know, when you're running a 100-mile race and you're 60 or 80 miles into the race, you know, your body is going to send you very strong signals of, you know, I want that and I don't want that. And so, and if you go by an aid station and you really want something, do it. You know, like, what's the worst that could happen? Even Ailsa at Sinister 7 last week, I went running by Leo's aid station at the end, and I did a shot of whiskey with the girls there. And so, and you know what, to be honest with you, it tasted great and I ran better after. And you know, who does whiskey while racing? So, but it's just, it makes you relax. You're like, okay, we're having a good time out here. For our audience that doesn't know, Leo Fung does this incredible aid station where he has like dance lights playing at night and a dance floor and loud music, and in the middle of the woods, it's really quite funny. It's it's pretty awesome.
I
stopped for a glass of wine in 2017 when I did Thursday. I was going to stop again this year for a shot of wine, but my stomach was pretty off, so I thought, no, I'm just going to get the race done. But it's a very uplifting aid station. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, you guys may think of it now. Leadville, Elsa, that would be a beautiful race for you to run Leadville. You know, running up over Hope Pass a couple of times, you could probably just crush people's souls. But on the way back, you may think of it with this station, there's these guys who are an unsanctioned aid station at the top of Sugarloaf on the way back. So it's probably mile, I want to say 80 to 85 in that range or so. And these guys, I think, are from the 60s. That's the way we best describe what they're up there doing. And they offer you sort of pretty much anything you want, you know, from pretzels to whatever else they have. But it's sort of just fun to see them, and they're playing music and having a good time and getting people's attention. But most people just run by it. But I think you would like Leadville. I mean, of course, the elevation has its way about, you know, messing with you when you start at 10,000 feet and you really never go below that. But there's some good running that could be had in that race. So we'll have to convince you to get down to Colorado. And
I would love to run in Colorado. There's so many great races down there, and I've never really explored that country. So that is on my bucket list. I don't know what particular race, but yeah, something in Colorado for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Elsa, we're getting to that point of the podcast where we get talking about what's next. You know, our podcast is the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. You know, you and I, you know, we're always looking and peeking around the corner to kind of see what's next for us personally, you know, as runners and as parents and as really humans on this planet, you know, all doing this together. And so what's next for you? What does the next year look like? I know you really want to get to UTMB, you know, the Canadian travel restrictions right now with COVID-19, hopefully you know, drifting away, but what's next for you?
Well, if I can make it to UTMB this year, then that's what's next. But so next year looks like Western States is going to be my A race. I've been holding my golden ticket now for 2 years, so it'll be nice to cash that in. And it'll be interesting to go into Western States now that I have the trail running training under my belt too, because when I did it in 2018, it was my second 100-miler. I still wasn't running on trail. So I think I'm a bit stronger now than I was back then. Physically and mentally. So I'm excited to go to that one. And then I don't know what I'll do after that. There's so many unknowns right now with the way the world is. So it's been really difficult to plan really far ahead. But yeah, definitely Western States for 2022.
All right. Well, we'll be cheering you along the way. We'll hope that we can track you at UTMB. I've ridden my bike around Mont Blanc. I haven't run up it, but it is quite spectacular. I will say that much. So the scenery there is about some of the most amazing, you know, in the world. I mean, the Canadian Rockies are gorgeous. The U.S. Rockies are great, but that is just like the Alps are unique in their own way. So some fun. Up and down.
Yeah, I was there for CCC in 2019, so I have a bit of familiarity with the course, so I'm excited to go back and see what I can do for the full circumference of Mont Blanc.
All right. Well, Elsa, we appreciate you being on. We wish you the best the rest of the year. Congrats on your win, and especially on beating Dave. We won't let him live that time.
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
It was fantastic to actually finally run with you, and we got to share like the whole first leg together. And
absolutely, that was a blast. It was a blast. Absolutely. Yeah. No, please give our love to Barry.
Yes.
Will do. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thank you so much. Have a great one.
All right, Dave. You have to love Elsa. I mean, she's so unassuming. I'm not sure she really knows how good she is. But I guess we're all going to find out with her taking on Mont Blanc this year and Western States maybe next year. I don't know. This could be quite the back-to-back there. You know, but maybe most of all, what I'm laughing inside knowing is that she beat you at Sinister 7. You might need to do a bit more training, my friend. No excuses, huh? Well, there you have it. That's a wrap for this week. As always, a big shout out to our sponsor, Performance Tee. You can find them on www.performancetee.com, and they've given us a discount code for any of our listeners to get 20% off their product. Just use Chasing20 at checkout. And we'd greatly appreciate if you could follow us on Instagram and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That would be awesome. As always, a huge thanks to our listeners for coming with us on this journey and chasing tomorrow with us. Thanks.